Hello, and welcome to the TAA Audio Conference, An Academic Introduction to Trade Book Authorship, presented by Rutgers University Professor Paula Caliguri and freelance editor Elsa Peterson. Authoring a nonfiction paperback for general readers, in industry parlance, a trade book, is an adventure into the unknown for many academics, even those who have been prolific in academic publishing. Decisions to be made include which facets of my academic expertise will interest general audiences, how should I adapt my writing style in authoring a trade book, what should my manuscript and book proposal look like, do I need an agent and how do I find one, how will I negotiate a contract with a publisher, what will I do to publicize my book? Paula and Elsa, who recently worked together on Paula's first trade book, will discuss these and other questions. Paula is a professor in the Human Resource Management Department at Rutgers University, where she has directed the Center for HR Strategy since 2001. She has been recognized as one of the most prolific authors in the field of international business for her work in global careers, international human resource management, and global leadership development. In addition to her recent trade book, Get a Life, Not a Job, published this year by FT Press, Paula co-authored two books for human resource management professionals, Harmonizing Work, Family, and Personal Life, published by Cambridge Press in 2008, and Managing the Global Workforce, published this year by Wiley. Paula has also covered career-related topics for CNN and has hosted a pilot for a television show, Career Watch. Paula holds a PhD from Penn State University in Industrial and Organizational Psychology. Elsa has been doing editorial work primarily for the college textbook industry since 1984. Although her academic background is in music, she holds a BA with highest honors from the University of California at Riverside and an MA from Case Western Reserve University. Her versatile editing talents have led her into a wide variety of disciplines, ranging from the arts and humanities to psychology, business and management, human physiology and nutrition, and foreign language. She was a senior development editor for psychology with McGraw-Hill Higher Education and has freelanced for virtually every leading textbook publisher in the U.S. In addition to manuscript development, she has experience in permissions editing, picture research, and writing content for textbook ancillaries. I want to remind everyone again who is called in to press 4-star to mute yourself. And if you have any questions during the call, you can press 4-star again. I now turn the session over to Paula and Elsa.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
You're welcome.
Great to be with you. Thanks very much. I'm so glad that Paula had time to be with us today, and I know she's got a lot of valuable information to share with us. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through the questions that Kim was just talking about, such as, what facets of my academic expertise will interest general audiences? We're going to work our way through those questions, and every 10 minutes or so, we will open up the line for listener questions. So we will tell you when we're ready to receive some questions on whatever material we've just covered. So, Paula, are you ready?
I sure am.
Okay, well, let's get started. Let's just briefly look at how an academic author can decide which facets of their expertise are going to be interesting for general readers. How do you look at everything that you know as a professor, as an academic professional, and say, what can I write about that people who are not in my field would want to read about? What was that like for you, Paula?
Oh, sure. Actually, that's a great place to start. You know, it's funny. So much of what we do as academics, we have to face it, is pretty boring. What is the thing that we talk about that helps those around us maybe pique their interest a little bit, something that we can offer that might be a little bit entertaining, something that's a bit interesting? Perhaps we're, you know, whatever our content area is, we've done a study that seems interesting. Basically, what I've found is when I'm doing something that the general audience, like just family and friends, seem interested in, that seemed to be a good indicator of what would work well for a book. So for me personally, you know, so my very personal situation was that my expertise was in global human resource management. I mean, frankly, none of my family or friends were interested in global human resource management. What I did do, though, is I was running the center, as you mentioned in the intro, Kim. I was running the Center for HR Strategy for almost 10 years. And in that time, learned quite a bit about, because of the nature of the companies I was working with, learned quite a bit about the employment relationship. So in about 2008, some friends, family members, people I love the most in the world were losing their jobs and came to me and said, okay, Paula, what just happened? 20 years with the company. I was loyal, committed, hardworking. What just happened? And that actually gave me the motivation to write, but actually pushed me into realizing that there was a book in me that needed to be told. So I guess my advice, so that was my case. My advice for those listening would be, think about, you know, what are you an expert in, but what's resonating with those around you.
So what do people ask you about somebody, if you're a biologist and somebody comes to you and says, well, I just had this meeting with my doctor, or I just read this article in the newspaper, explain so-and-so to me. That might be a starting point for somebody?
Absolutely, sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what about the writing itself? You're used to writing for academic colleagues. What changes did you have to make when you wrote this book?
The style is very different. It's more personal. It's much more informal. My style, I write blogs now. My style is for the trade press, was very much, I guess, informal is the best way to describe it. I'm trying to tell a story. I'm trying to convey practical information that people can use now, especially the genre that get a life, not a job. That genre in particular was considered self-help careers. So I wanted to make sure the words on the page were things that people could see and relate to and feel and maybe motivate to do something different. That was really that was the style, that was the tone, compared to certainly the way I would write my textbooks or academic press. That was that follows a formula that we all know well as academics.
So your opening assumption was that your reader was somebody who did not know about your field.
Correct. Well, my operating assumption is that those who are picking up the book, I guess it should go back to when I signed my trade press contract, my senior acquisition editor said to me, Paula, my husband's an academic. It is going to kill me to say this to you, but there are two things that will sell your book: the cover and how many people know you. So I know we're going to talk about how many the author's platform in a little bit, but that first issue of the cover, I mean, face it, people are buying a trade press book because there's something that's resonating about the cover or the content. There's something that they want to know. So I'm operating under the assumption that maybe there's more of a motivation and less of knowledge, that people are coming to your book for that knowledge.
So they want answers.
Right.
They want to be able to pick up that book and get answers to some burning question that's bothering them or something that they're passionate about finding out about. That's wonderful. And I felt when I looked at your manuscript, because I had worked on some of your other more academic type of writings, I felt like you were really writing from the heart here, and it was lovely.
Thanks. It was a labor of love. Again, think about the time when most of that book was written. It was late 2008, early 2009. Unemployment was starting to rise. It was alarming a lot of people. It was affecting a lot of people. You heard all kinds of, it's tragic now, certainly, but at the time, it seemed like we were getting story after story of really heartbreaking stories of mass layoffs. So it was coming from a good place. It was coming because I really wanted to get the word out.
You really wanted to help, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what about the imperatives that every academic has had drummed into them from the time that they were in college, which is that whenever you write, you have to give credit for your ideas, and you're also supposed to be making some kind of a contribution with what you write. You're supposed to be advancing theories or advancing interpretation of work that other scholars have done. How does that come into play with a book for general audiences?
Right. I think every author's different in the way he or she may write for a trade press compared to how you'd write in an academic sense. Here's what worked for me. When I write for trade, I sit down and I write. I write what I know. I write what's coming from the heart. I write what I think people would want to hear who are interested in the topic. that forms the outline, that forms the content. And then what I do is I go back and I put in, if, for instance, there's a great study out there that did a terrific job illustrating a point, I tell the story of the study. And I'll tell you, people who do this exceptionally well, Dan Pink, Malcolm Gladwell, they do this very, very well in terms of just, you know, sharing a particular research story, a study, and then sharing it as a story. So I'd add that back in. And then the next thing I would do is add in, if there was a dominant theory, if somebody advanced a particular theory that's clearly influenced what I'm saying in the book, then I would give credit to the person for pioneering the theory, or give them credit for the role in developing the field. But I don't so much, as you described, I don't write like we do in academe, where you cite every fourth word. I write what I know. That's what works for me. Again, I think we all might have slightly different styles.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's great. So now that we've discussed this initial process of deciding what to write about and how to write it, maybe we can see whether our listeners have any questions for us. Kim, you want to just remind everybody one more time how to unmute themselves if they have a question?
Yes, you can just press 4-star to unmute yourself and then press 4-star again to remute yourself after you've asked your question.
I'm unmuted. This is Marty.
Hi, Marty.
Hi, Marty.
Hi. My question is it possible to have too wide an audience? That is to say, the readership that I have in mind for the book that I'm doing is very wide, and part of what I'm struggling with is accommodating everyone that I'm imagining in my head who might read this.
This is Paula. I may answer that just in terms of the feedback I was given, Marty. When I decided to write Get a Life, Not a Job, I thought the same thing. I'm writing this for everyone. I'm writing this for every employed person who may be slightly dissatisfied with his or her position, which covers a wide swath. And basically what I was told was, Paula, narrow the focus. No book is really great for everyone. Target those who are currently unemployed, recently unemployed, or truly unhappy, not fulfilled in their careers. You know, it's not a book for everyone. So, again, not knowing your topic, I can't say that the same applies. My belief is still that my book is great for everyone, but I think from my publicist's ear, my publisher's ear, my agent's ear, they saw it as a tighter niche.
Okay. Thank you.
Did that help, Marty?
It certainly does, and it's hard to ask a follow-up question without going into more detail on my particular project, so I won't do that. I'll just try your advice, which is to narrow somewhat. Thank you.
Yeah, and maybe when we talk more about publicizing and so forth, that may also help to give you an idea of how to proceed.
Okay, thanks very much. I will unmute.
Thanks. Do we have any other questions coming in? Okay, sounds like we don't. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is Richard. Quick question.
Hi,
about
Richard.
About the two of you. I gather from earlier remarks that you've worked together on several books. How did you find one another, and how would you characterize that relationship that the two of you have developed?
Paula?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, I found Elsa because I was talking to two of my friends, dear friends and colleagues who also write textbooks, and was mentioning at the time that I was working on a textbook and really could use the benefit of having a good editor to work with. And they said, oh, you need to call Elsa. Okay, I called Elsa. Elsa was terrific. She first started helping me with my academic text, and then when the Get a Life, Not a Job came up, that's when we started working together on that.
Yeah, and we had never seen each other in person until maybe like 2 years after we started working together, Paula?
Correct, yeah, it was all online.
Yeah, so it was all by phone, by email. Now I work with most of my clients. There used to be that you would come to a meeting in New York City at the publisher, and you know, they would fly the author in from wherever, but that really doesn't happen anymore. So it's all done remotely. But we met each other through referrals, and I get most of my work through, I guess you would say, word of mouth. Generally publishing companies that hire me, but sometimes authors hire me themselves, like in the case of Paula.
Richard, if I may, you had asked about how do we characterize the relationship. I would say it's well-developed because I think when Elsa and I first started working together, there's some period of time that it takes for an editor to help, you know, the author, especially when I began this, was one, finding a voice, and especially the textbook, but then over time, not changing the voice that I had. So, Elsa, maybe you could comment more on this, but I think you began to adopt a little bit more or understand more of how I wrote, perhaps?
Probably, yeah. I think that that's always a process when a certain author and a certain editor start working together. But definitely with Get a Life, Not a Job, I felt that, I'm not sure if you felt the same way, but I felt like I edited with a very light hand because I could see that you weren't writing in your academic style. You were writing as yourself, and I didn't want to interfere with how you expressed yourself.
Yeah, I would agree.
Question?
Hi.
Hi, this is Michael Lenny.
Michael,
can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Follow-up question to Richard's. The answer seemed to say how that relationship came about, but there's nothing generic that other authors could really pick up on other than perhaps talk to your colleagues. But is there any more generic answer to that question, how you find an editor? And a subpart of that is if you're writing the trade book based on your textbook, or based on that subject matter, is that a different editor than the editor you want to find, you know, to help you with the textbook? So it's really how do you go about
finding. I think that could be a whole, that could kind of be a teleconference in itself, but I guess the short answer is I belong to a couple of organizations, the Editorial Freelancers Association, which has a find an editor function on its website, and also the National Association of Independent Writers and Editors. So through both of those organizations, I think you can find people, you can look at people's resumes, you can look by the kinds of expertise that different people have, and then, you know, most editors are willing to have a phone conversation and do a short sample, maybe like 3 pages of editing, to give you a sense of how they work, so that you sort of know what you're getting into and they sort of know what they're getting into in seeing a portion of one of your manuscripts. But that really, that could be a whole teleconference in itself. So maybe, you know, if you want to send me an email offline, I'm sure Kim will give out the contact information after this teleconference. I could give you some more information, Michael.
Okay. Elsa, could you repeat the names of those two associations again? Editorial Freelance.
The Editorial Freelancers Association. And the National Association of Independent Writers and Editors. I know that's a little bit of a mouthful. National Association of Independent Writers and Editors.
Thank you.
Okay, so we probably better move along to our next topic. Thanks, everyone, for those questions. Now, the next thing we're going to talk about is a book proposal. Which is the next thing that happens when you've got your book conceptualized and you've written at least part of it, you've got a table of contents. What should the manuscript and the book proposal look like? So I'll sort of start out here, and Paula can tell me more details about how she experienced this. But the major piece of news for people who are writing for the trade book press, writing for general audiences, is that you don't have to finish the whole book before you show it to an agent or a publisher. What you do need is a table of contents, a fairly detailed outline probably of the whole book, 1 or 2 chapters, and a really, really good book proposal. So what is a book proposal? That can depend on who you're submitting it to, and There is a handout that I think Kim may have already sent out. If not, she's going to send it out after this teleconference, giving you some books that tell how to write a book proposal and also some websites. But the proposal is going to basically say why this is a good book, why people will want to read it, why you're qualified to be the one writing it, how it differs from other books that are already out there, and what's special about this and why they would want to publish this book. Paula, do you want to elucidate on any of those points?
Actually, also, that's exactly what is in a book proposal. I think that's fairly standard. I had to smile, though, when you said you don't want to finish the book before you send out the proposal. With Get a Life, Not a Job, I had finished the book before I sent out the proposal. So it was a situation where basically I had to go back with my working with my agent. I had to go back and then put together the book proposal, which I thought was rather interesting. The only thing I would add for the trade press market to a book proposal, and I promise you they'll ask for this, is the author's platform. They'll want to know what is your base of people who are interested in your work, interested in your topic, who might be attracted to buying your publication once it's out. So that was actually a very big part of the trade press compared to the text.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a weak point with me because I've never had to go out and do it, and I'm sure I would have a hard time if it was my book. But yeah, that word platform, it has a special meaning in trade publishing. It means how many people know you and like you and are interested in what you're doing.
And it's beyond, I think, because the market is so difficult right now, and I guess I just want to share this story, if I may. When I first started shopping, actually when my agent first started shopping Get a Life, Not a Job around, I had already started doing the appearances on CNN, thinking that that was in and of itself a pretty good platform, that the national visibility. That wasn't enough. They wanted to know how many people were following my blog. I didn't have a blog. They wanted to know how many people followed me on Twitter. I didn't know what Twitter was. They wanted to know how many of my students were connecting with me on Facebook, or how many people connected with me, how many fans I had on Facebook. I never had a Facebook fan page. So all of these things ended up becoming really very much a developmental process for me in developing my author's platform. And unfortunately for me, it was while the book was getting marketed. So in the perfect world, my recommendation is try to develop that author's platform to be very solid before you submit your book proposal, and before the book comes out, because it means the chances of success are so much greater.
That's great, and I know we're going to talk about publicity more when we get to the end of this presentation. And so in the meantime, I'll just reiterate, and this will be on the handout. Very briefly, I was just going to say that there are some useful books out on the market. There's a book called Bulletproof Book Proposals. There's a book called How to Write a Book Proposal. There's a Thinking Like Your Editor, How to Write Great Serious Nonfiction and Get It Published. And then there's a more general book about publishing called Getting It Published, A Guide for Scholars and Anyone Else Serious About Serious Books. And then there's Writer's Market and the Literary Marketplace. Those are both available online as well as in print. And particularly Writer's Market is very oriented towards people who write nonfiction and fiction. You do have to, you'll be in that mix with people who are writing novels. Who want to know how to find the right agent for them, how to find the right publisher. And also it gives information about options in self-publishing too, which we're not going to talk about today, but those are very, very useful resources, and they are in the handout that Kim is either going to send out or did already send out. I'm not sure.
Yes, that's what I was trying to say when I accidentally ended the call, was that it will be included in the follow-up email that everyone will receive after the audio conference. It'll be a link to downloading the PDF from the TA website.
Excellent. Okay, that's great. Now let's turn our focus to the process of finding an agent. We've said that an agent can help you a lot, but let's find out from Paula exactly what was it like finding an agent and how did your agent help you?
Sure. Also, this too, everything comes with a story. This too had a bit of a story. At the point when I was looking for I can't even say I was looking for an agent for Get a Life, Not a Job. I didn't even know I needed an agent for Get a Life, Not a Job. I actually had contacted my publishers for my academic writings, thinking that this would be a fairly easy proposal. You know, I had the book. The book was finished. That was a good thing. I was fairly certain that this was, you know, there was something to offer here. I was very surprised when they came back and said, Paula, we want to help. However, this isn't really our area. It's not our division. It's a separate division. And, oh, by the way, we think, you know, we're trying to help you out here. We think you need an agent. So, oh, okay, fine. So I did what we do. You know, you call and talk to colleagues, or this is at least what I did. I talked to some colleagues who had written, who crossed over from academic to trade writing, and asked them who their agents were, started contacting them. Again, the only thing I had now was the finished manuscript. I didn't have a proposal. Sent that out to some prospective agents. So these were folks who came referred. Was real surprised when the answer was, sorry, not interested. And, sorry, not interested. I got that response quite a few times. And I went, wow, I thought getting a publisher was the goal. It wasn't. At this point, it was getting the agent was the goal. So finally, my agent, Joe Veltri, had written me back and said, Paul, I liked your book. And actually, he said the words I so most wanted to hear. He said, I would love to give this book to a friend of mine who just lost his job. So I thought, okay, great. I found my agent, and he's been absolutely terrific ever since. So my process for finding an agent, to the issue earlier, I don't know how to make this generic advice. Elsa, maybe you could help with that. The way I did it was basically contacting some agents that came to my attention.
Well, that's one good way to do it. Now, if you don't happen to have any friends who have published trade books who are willing to tell you who their agents are, the other thing you can do is stop in at any bookstore and look at some books on the shelf that are in the area where you envision your book being on that bookstore shelf, and look in the acknowledgments of those books, and very often the author will say, I want to thank my agent so-and-so. Jot down those names, go home, look up those agents, see what their submission guidelines are, get in touch with them, see if they're interested in your book. And if they say no, when you query them to begin with, you know, say to them, if you don't think this is the best book for you to be representing, who else do you know that I might show it to? So just use that networking skill. Don't say, do you know anybody? Because that's a yes or no question, and they can just say, no, I don't know anybody. Say, who else do you know? So it's an open-ended question, and it gives them more of a motivation to give you an answer. So once you found Joe Veltri and became your agent, what did he do for you, Paula?
Well, he then did what he does. You know, I guess this is what agents do. They send out – oh, so I'll tell you, he first had me write a book proposal. Again, the book is now finished, so here I am writing a book proposal. He was the one who worked with me very closely on trying to at least put whatever I could possibly put together in terms of an author's platform, in terms of what I had. He was the one who encouraged me to start – getting out there in social media. That actually came in full force when I picked up my publicist. But at that point, he helped me with the book proposal, helped me with the author's platform, and then he took it over from there. He sent it out to different prospective publishers, and ultimately FT Press said yes, which was great.
And for those who don't know FT Press, FT stands for Financial Times, right?
Correct.
And it's connected with the periodical, the Financial Times. So FT Press publishes business-related titles, right?
Right, and it's an imprint of Pearson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to put it in very I don't know, elementary terms for somebody like myself who has never had an agent or I don't even really know any agents personally, they're the ones who have connections with different publishing houses. So they're sort of a gatekeeper in the sense that the publishing houses, the acquiring editors at the publishing houses know if they hear from a certain agent, they hear from Joe Veltri, they know that what he's asking them to take a look at has already been checked out by him and that he thinks it's worthwhile. So it's different from something just coming in from any person out in the universe saying, oh, I've got a great book for you. That a lot of publishers won't even look at a proposal at all if it doesn't come from an agent. Some of them will. And you can tell that by the listings in Writer's Market and Literary Marketplace. There are often indications of who will look at unsolicited proposals and who won't. But most of the, I guess you would say, top-flight publishers almost never will look at a proposal, let alone at a manuscript, from directly from an author. They want it to be from an agent because they know that the agent, they can rely on the agent to make certain judgments and to work with an author to get something up to speed before it comes to their desk. Do you think that's a fair description of what an agent does in terms of the acquiring phase?
Absolutely. I couldn't underscore more that they're gatekeepers. Absolutely, they're gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're known for certain areas, they're known for niches, they're known for genres. They're known among the publishers.
Mm-hmm. And you have to pay them.
I guess each one is individually negotiated. In my case, I think it's fairly standard with the 15%. Yeah.
Right. But they shouldn't take money up front, right? I've always been told if somebody is a legitimate literary agent, they don't charge you anything up front to just look at your material because they make money when you get published. And
right. If
an agent doesn't have a track record of getting anybody published, that's when they might get into the business of just charging you some sort of like a reading fee or an application fee. And it can turn out that they aren't really a legitimate agent. All they're doing is sort of giving people feedback for a certain amount of money. But your chances of being able to get published through them are probably not that great.
Correct. High quality agents will not, to the best of my knowledge, will not request any money up front. It's on a percentage.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So Joe found you a publisher, and then at that point you're negotiating your contract with FT Press. And how did that go? What was that all about?
Well, he was negotiating the contract. I thought the very first offer, well, actually, I probably shouldn't say. He was negotiating the contract. So thankfully for me, I have the world's worst negotiating skills. I was just so very excited. Again, the book was finished. I was at this point just wanting so much for the book. I was ready to staple it and put copies out in Barnes & Noble myself. It was really the kind of thing that I just wanted to see it out. So thankfully, he basically said, Paula, let's slow this down a little and let's see what we can do here. And thankfully, he did. And because of him, I received a wonderful advance.
So. Okay, the way the advance thing works, for those who haven't done that, is the author gets some money up front, and then as the book sells, you get royalties, and if you do well, you earn out your advance. If the book doesn't sell well, say the book is a complete flop, you still don't have to give the money back, but it's called an advance. I mean, the term advance in my mind always used to mean that it was some sort of like a loan almost that you'd have to pay it back if your book didn't sell enough copies. But that's generally not the case. You get the advance. It's like an upfront payment. And then they hope that your book will do really well, that you will earn out your advance, and then you'll start receiving royalty payments after that as well.
Correct.
Okay, I've got that right. I'm just because I've never actually been in that position, but that's the way it has always been explained to me.
And I think some of the – no, you've described it very well. I think some of the advances, you see a check fairly early on in the process, and sometimes they stagger them. So they might – again, I'm sure every contract is different, but my understanding from Joe and from the process was that Sometimes they'll give a portion of the advance at the very beginning and then a portion of the advance when you actually deliver the completed manuscript. So I guess each contract, I would assume, is slightly different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and a couple of the other things in your contract had to do with your control over the title and the publicizing of the book.
Right. When I signed over the rights to the book, I mean, part of the things I signed over were the rights to the cover and the name of the book. The original title, I keep calling it Get a Life, Not a Job. That wasn't even my title. I wish I could take credit for it. I can't. They actually had a branding and naming team assigned to the book who read the book and then came up with the title. I had no ability to weigh in. My original book title was called The Three-Ring Career, which my publisher said sounded too chaotic, and she didn't think it would sell books. That's actually the point when she said, Paula, your book's going to sell on two things, the cover and how many people know you. So they did. I thought they did a great job. The book cover's lovely. The title's catchy. So I think they did a nice job with that. But, right, I had no rights to that.
If you're taking questions.
Cool. Actually, yes, this probably is a good point to pause and take questions. I'd just like to share one little thing. There's a lovely quote that I found on an internet site by a gentleman named Morris Rosenthal, who is an author, and he says, there's nothing quite like the feeling of joining a prestigious author's guild after publishing a trade book, sending them the publisher's book contract for your next edition for the free legal review, and hearing something like, oh, you never should have signed that first contract. Now you're stuck with it forever. So that's the nice thing about having a good agent and probably also having a good lawyer look over your contract before you sign in the first place.
Well, my question goes exactly to that. When the author has identified a potential agent and that potential agent has indicated possible interest, how do you know if you've got a good agent? How do you know whether it's the right agent to work with?
I guess it's kind of like when somebody proposes marriage to you. How do you know if you're marrying the right person? It really comes down to a lot of how you feel about your interactions with that person, as well as the written material that they give you that specifies what your relationship with the agent is going to consist of.
So the agent will have a contract that he gives to you. There is an agent's contract.
Correct. There was an agent. There was a contract that I had with my agent. Correct. And I think there are two other things I may add to what Elsa just shared. One was referrals, as Elsa mentioned earlier. I also said, boy, you know, do you know of anyone, or could you name some other people who might be interested in representing this book? So there was a trail back to kind of the original person who I knew and trusted. And so when I went back to that original person I knew and trusted and said, hey, I just this agent, I'm about to sign with this particular agent, he said, oh, that's terrific. This person is wonderful and very well respected. So there was kind of a bit of a credibility check just through the network. And then the second thing I did, and I guess I wish I could share a certain site. I'm sorry, I don't know of one, but I Googled them, which I think is sort of the standard way of learning about people. And all of the feedback was very positive. Even people who had been rejected said that he gave some very constructive feedback, and he was a gentleman. He was a really nice guy. He gave good advice, or they were pleased with the relationship. So I didn't see anything negative or anything that would be concerning.
Comment?
Sure. Yep.
This is Michael Lenny. On the question of the contract, I am an attorney as well as a literary agent and have negotiated a lot of contracts, but the statement about that first contract tying you up for life, there's a little bit of hyperbole there, but not a lot.
Okay.
And two items have that effect. One is an option clause, and you never have to sign a contract with an option clause. You can strike it. It never will kill the deal. And the second is a competing works clause. If that's too broad, then it can exclude you from a lot of other writing.
Yeah, those are good points. I mean, I know we could also have a complete teleconference on contracts for trade books. I know GAA has had at least one teleconference on author contracts for textbooks and academic publishing. But yeah, so there's lots of ins and outs. But in general, with any contract, you'll always know that you have the power to question things. I mean, there may be things that are deal killers, but you can always, you know, flag things in the contract and say, well, I'm not completely comfortable with the way this is phrased. And but getting back to the question of how do you know that an agent is right for you, another thing is that on the agent's website, they should list some of the authors that they represent. And you can go and look in the acknowledgments of books by those authors and see if their whatever they say about the agent is really glowing or if it's just sort of perfunctory, yeah, and my agent is so-and-so. you probably have to do a little bit of reading between the lines, but there are just certain ways of sort of through networking and through snooping in the acknowledgment sections of books that you can kind of get a feel for whether an agent is highly respected or not so much. I hope that's a little bit helpful at least. So our last topic that we're going to cover today has to do with publicizing, and this is where I know almost zero. So Paula, take it away.
And I have to say, I knew almost zero as well. In fact, I'd say zero would be about what I knew when someone said you need an author's platform. And I think I've shared a little bit about this. So an author's platform is really the answer to the question, who knows you, how many people know you, who's connected with you, how many organizations or individuals will want to buy the book once it's out. Give us evidence, author, of your ability to sell a lot of books. That's really the platform. Certainly, celebrities, they have a very easy platform. Very well-known scholars who are also on the executive ed circuit, who do a lot of corporate speaking, they have a terrific author's platform. For those who are really doing trade press that maybe is a bit more of the mass market, popular side, again, I think it depends on maybe what you've generated up until now. I guess for me, what I wish, and this might surprise you, if I could do it again, even though the book was finished, if I could do it all over again, I think I would have slowed down, built the platform for about 6 months, and then tried to go for, and not the agent, because my agent was terrific, but then maybe tried to market the book. It's that critical. The market is so tight right now. It's so tough to get a contract that I think the book would have, or potentially I would have done better if my author's platform was stronger. So things I guess in hindsight, what I would have done probably would have started my blog earlier. My blog's been going about a year. I'd say about a year and 2 months now. My book has been out for about 6 months. I think if I had more time with the blog, because now I've got lots of people reading the blog, which would have been nice to have at the onset. The idea of this Facebook fan page, I'm not a huge fan of Facebook in that I really don't put much on there, but I convey information that the people who, if you liked my book, you might also like the types of things I'm leaving on Facebook, some additional things for you to read, maybe some articles I've found, some quotes or things or experiences. That seems to be picking up some steam as well, but it's picking up steam now after the book as opposed to prior to the book being launched. Twitter.
Now, what about things like, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, Twitter was actually the last one. Again, I'm not a big social media maven, so I don't use it probably as one is supposed to. But I certainly, again, what I've seen since the book's been launched, a lot of people seem to be following me on Twitter, and mostly what I do is I convey information. So basically, if you liked my book, I'll be happy to provide you more information on Twitter and Facebook and then through the blog.
question. This is Richard again.
Yes.
You seem to have spent quite a bit of time on your blog, and your earlier remarks suggest that you wish you had spent more time on the blog developing your platform before you actually went for publication. Could you characterize a bit more what you would have put into your blog before the book was out in order to build interest in it?
Sure. I think for me it's an issue of time. So my book was released in the spring, this past spring. I started my blog in the summer before. So only having the blog really in motion for about 6 months prior to the book's launch didn't really give it enough steam. So in other words, with respect to the content, I wouldn't have changed anything. I like the content. I think it strikes the right tone. I like the way I communicate with people who are following it. I'm happy with the writing. But it just, prior to the book's launch, it wasn't around long enough. And so actually backing up from there, at the point when Joe was trying to go out and make a case for my book, I didn't even have a blog. So what I meant was not that I would have changed the content of it, it was just the duration of it being out there. Did that answer it, Richard? No.
How does the content relate to the book, the content of the blog? I'm interested in that interrelationship.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I misunderstood the question.
I would not want to give the book away in the blog.
Correct.
Because that would seem to me to undercut its potential sales. So what do you put in a blog to stimulate interest in the book that doesn't tell the story before the story is told?
Sure. I think it's your expertise, and I don't know your area of expertise. I mean, from mine, and please try to generalize as you will. So my area in this case was career advice. I tell lots of stories about, you know, personal situations that have happened in my life that helped develop my career or develop an aspect of my career. Sometimes I find an article just in our academic press that looks real interesting, and I kind of do a bit of a research translation and make it a little lighter, certainly crediting the authors who wrote the study, but actually sharing it in a more accessible way. I do some... If I do a CNN appearance that might be useful for the blog, I'll actually put that on as a cast that they can watch. I do different things with the blog. Periodically, I reference back to the blog or to the book. The rule of thumb, and actually it was a piece of advice that my publicist gave me. The rule of thumb is give. Just give. Give information. Give advice. Give whatever tools. Knowledge, make people want to come to you, you being your blog, your Facebook page, your Twitter. They want to come to you for sound knowledge on that topic. So once your book comes out, of course they're going to buy it. And that's really what the author's platform is. You become such the known expert that once your book comes out, of course people want it.
As you're talking, it's kind of making me think of some of the blogs that are on the New York Times, like Tara Parker Pope has a blog about health. So if you found out that Tara Parker Pope has a new book coming out, you already know, oh, she's the one who writes that blog on the New York Times about health topics, and she's got this book about, adolescent health or women's health or whatever. And then you go, oh, well, I bet she's got some good information in there, and you're a lot more likely to pick up that book than somebody else's book on a similar topic.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
And this is
another
question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Once a contract is signed with a publisher, agent's done his job, now you've got the publisher's contract. How long, typically, from that moment until the book is out?
I don't know typical. Elsa can probably give you the timeline a little bit better than I could. For me, it was roughly 1 year. Maybe a little less than that, 10 months. From the time I had the contract, there was a fair amount of development work that they wanted to do with it. They, believe it or not, thought it was still too academic. So we did some work on that. They changed. I had some elements in it that they didn't like. We removed them. Did a couple of things. By the time the book was going under a broader review, let's see, August, from the point of contract, I'd say 10 months. For me, it took 10 months.
I think that's probably pretty typical. There are books that come out much faster. I know even back in the early 1990s, St. Martin's Press had one department that did instant books, and if there was something really hot in the news, it was usually like a big crime story, somebody getting murdered, but not always. They would come out with this instant book within a month of the event. And it would be nonfiction. It would be written, telling the story in a journalistic kind of approach. So it can be done a lot faster than the 9 or 10 months. But I think 9 or 10 months is probably still pretty typical the way most of the publishing houses work.
And if there's a particular season during which the book should be available, will a publisher normally work with the author to get it out at that right time of year?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because it's in their best interest to see the book sell. I mean, for me, it was the dads and grad season, so they wanted to get it out in advance of graduation in the hopes to make it graduation gifts.
Mm-hmm. So how much lead? So about 10 months lead time is what you need to give a publisher in order to have it out prior to whatever season it is you're aiming for.
Correct. And I think Elsa's point is well taken. If there's a huge burning interest for them to get the book out quickly, and if the author has a lot of free time to do his or her part and they have the editorial team in place, I think the book can come out very quickly at the point when it needs to. But I think for me they wanted it out in the spring, and that's when it came out.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean it's in their interest to have it come out at the advantageous time because they want to sell books. I mean I know over the years in working as an editor, I've had at least one author say to me, "I don't really care whether this book makes any money." And I go, well, you may not care, but the publisher cares because they're only in business to make money. So they, if the books don't sell, why would they want to publish them?
Another question along that line. Recently, maybe the last 8 or 10 years, universities are adopting a book that they're asking all of their incoming freshmen to read before those students arrive on campus. If an author has a book that she thinks might be suitable for that audience, how would you connect into that phenomenon?
I don't have a clue. Would your publicist know about that, Paula?
My publicist was amazing, but his role was not to try to get my book adopted in an academic setting. My sense is that if your publishing house has a trade side but also a text side and that they view it as a crossover book, which some of the books are, my sense is that the person who's the sales rep who handles the accounts that, for those particular courses would be, given the title of the book and kind of some talking points on how to encourage the book to be sold within that area. I have another book, Managing the Global Workforce, that was a crossover book, and that's exactly what I was told happened. So it didn't have as broad of an audience as you're describing, but it was primarily being sold in two ways. It was being sold as a trade press, but it was also being sold to academics to adopt in courses.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for that question. And so, Paula, just to clarify a little bit more the role of the publicist also, like the agent, has to get paid. And if I'm understanding it correctly, the publicist is in a way kind of similar to an agent in that if they call up, say, the Oprah show and they say, "I've got a terrific person for you to interview," that call is going to get a lot more attention than if just some person out of the blue tries to call up the Oprah show and says, "I want to be on your show with my book."
Correct, correct, yeah. And unlike the agent, though, you do pay your publicist. So what I ended up doing was taking a fair amount of my advance money and paying for a publicist in the hopes that that would return. So that's it's a different type of relationship. Your publicist is out there to try to get you your book reviewed by all the major news agencies, to get you on television shows, to get you onto local onto radio shows and the like. So in my case, his role was very much to get me out there.
Terrific. And then what about just appearances, like speaking at conferences? Are you able to mention this book if you're basically on the program with an academic presentation? Can you still talk about this book, or do you find that just doesn't work?
It honestly doesn't work very well. I began this by saying I'm known for international human resources. So people who are coming to hear me talk about international human resources, they tend to not be particularly interested in my views on careers. People who want to hear me talk about careers probably aren't interested in the international HR. Occasionally, I'll get people who are interested in both, but that's usually not a whole room full. So I usually talk about one or the other.
Could I ask a question about the publicist?
Sure.
How did your publicist and the publishing company's publicity department cooperate or compete or divide functions or get along?
That's a great question. They actually work together. So to your point, just as a point of clarification, so there were two publicists. There was the publicist for the publisher who was representing really the book first, me second. And then this is just my way of kind of seeing their roles. And then my publicist who was representing me as an author and the book. But the contract was, of course, around the book's publicity. I saw them working together. Frankly, what my publisher said was that because my particular publicist was very well known, and basically she said, listen, I will support his efforts in any way I can. So it was very much, she took, I think, a little bit of a backseat because he was doing most of the efforts.
Do we have any other questions? Looks like we're almost out of time.
A follow-up question about publicists might be then, how does one identify one of those?
In this case, my agent recommended a few publicists, and I spoke with a few publicists and just had a good relationship with, I liked my publicist. I liked his reputation and liked what he had done.
Okay. By reputation, did you Google him again?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
And frankly, my publisher also knew of him, and they were very excited when they found out that he was repping the book.
Excellent. Well, according to my clock, it looks like we're out of time. Kim, are we about to wrap up?
Yeah, I think we should wrap it up. So thank you, Paula and Elsa, for sharing your expertise with us, and thank you all for participating in today's audio conference. I will be sending you an email following the audio conference that includes a short survey about your experience today. Please take a moment to fill out the survey. Your responses will help us improve future audio conferences. The email will also include Elsa's contact information and links to the handout containing resources that Elsa and Paula have mentioned today, including the Editorial Freelancers Association, the National Association of Independent Writers and Editors, and TAA's list of editors offering TAA members discounts of up to 20%. So an academic's introduction to trade book authorship is an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association,